Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest in the hunt for the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls and speak with Mark Quarterman, the Director of Research and Programs at Enough, who was previously on the staff of the Africa Subcommittee of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. We'll investigate the links between northern Nigerian politicians and Boko Haram and discuss the state of the Nigerian military following reports that disgruntled soldiers in the capital of the state where Boko Haram is active fired on their commander's convoy in a protest over lack of pay and poor equipment. Then we'll examine the European Courts of Justice's decision against Google, requiring the tech giant to enact a right-to-be-left-alone regime that would allow individuals to demand that Google remove content from their search engines that the complainant disapproves of or considers out of date. Eva Galperin, a global policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, joins us to discuss the difficulty of enacting and enforcing this new law that advocates of internet freedoms see as arbitrary and censorious. Then finally, we will discuss the political and military stalemate in Syria with Nicholas Harris, an analyst with the Washington-based think tank, the Jamestown Foundation. He has just returned from the region where neighbors like Jordan and Lebanon are feeling the strain on food and water resources from millions of Syrian refugees as the killing of Syrians and the destruction of their country continues unabated. We'll discuss the resignation of the UN mediator on Syria, who, on the eve of a meeting in London of the U.S. Secretary of State and his European and Arab counterparts on the Syrian crisis, quit in despair over the lack of peace negotiations amid the increasingly outrageous suffering of the Syrian people. And joining us now is Mark Quarterman, who's Director of Research and Programs at Enough, where he formulates the Enough Project's policy prescriptions to end genocide and crimes against humanity and oversees rigorous field-based research and analysis in their reports and publications. Prior to joining the Enough Project, he was a senior advisor and director of the Program on Crisis, Conflict and Cooperation at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he also served at the United Nations for nearly 12 years, most recently as chief of staff of the UN Commission of Inquiry into the assassination of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan. Before joining the United Nations, Quarterman was a staff member of the Africa Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Quarterman.
Happy to be with you, Ian.
And there are reports out of Nigeria that there's been a sort of counterstrike, I guess, against Boko Haram in not too far from the village where 300 people were recently massacred on market day by Boko Haram. And about 200 militants were killed in this fighting where apparently the villagers were ready for Boko Haram and essentially ambushed them. But there's also a report which I think is pretty extraordinary, and that is that disgruntled Nigerian soldiers opened fire on a convoy of a top military commander in the main city of the state of Borno. And apparently no one was injured. And Major General Chris Olukade confirmed the incident had taken place, but said it was an internal matter and there was no reason for public concern. I mean, give me a break.
Yes. So soldiers fire on a commander and there's no reason to be concerned. As you probably know, the Nigerian military has a very long and somewhat checkered history. The reason I say somewhat is not entirely, but largely checkered history in Nigeria, having successfully launched a number of coups and having ruled the country for a number of years. It also, though, from most of the time from the country's independence, was the most organized and cohesive aspect of Nigerian society. And so people looked to them often for an example. That's begun to break down, and it broke down through the long years, of course, of military rule and misrule. And it's absolutely being highlighted now by the incapacity of the government, with, of course, the focus on the military, to do anything to stop Boko Haram or to rescue the girls who were kidnapped.
Well, apparently these soldiers fired on their commander because they are protesting against poor pay and the lack of equipment they need to go after Boko Haram.
Which is really interesting given the history of Nigeria, because the military was often the best supplied and most consistently paid group of civil servants in Nigeria. this just shows you how far the military has fallen, in part because civilian governments have been, if not starving, at least putting the military on a diet in order to prevent military coups, in this sense that the military had the power and the ability to take over governments.
So what is going on then in terms of the political arrangements in the North and the idea that there have been incidents in the past, particularly at the time of presidential elections, where you've had politicians deploying militias and harassing and intimidating and even assassinating their rivals? And, you know, one of the top people in Boko Haram was found in the state governor's house after escaping from police captivity, and a Nigerian senator was arrested on suspicion of aiding Boko Haram after they found that he telephoned them more than 70 times in 1 month. So what is this murky relationship between northern politicians and Boko Haram?
Well, that relationship exists in part because there's a very strong strain of Islamism in the north, and in part because Nigeria has never comfortably coexisted really as a unified country. There really is a strong north-south divide. During British colonialism, the south was directly ruled by Great Britain, and the north was indirectly ruled by Great Britain, which meant that some of the traditions of government organizations, civil service, the formation of universities to train a bureaucratic class, that was only done in the South. And the North was under the rule of traditional rulers. The North is overwhelmingly Muslim, which is neither here nor there because there are lots of Muslims in the South. But more importantly, it was on its own in many ways, starved of resources, economic development, and under the sway of traditional rulers in a way that the South wasn't. So when they became an independent country, that carried over in many ways. The military leaders were often traditionally from the North, and civilian politicians who were in positions of power traditionally from the South. This divide has really never been bridged, and effectively, the North continues to be relatively economically underdeveloped compared to the rest of the country. And as a result of poverty, a lack of governance, lack of support, there has been an attraction for political Islam in the North.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Quarterman, who's a director of research and programs at Enough, where he formulates the Enough Project's policy prescriptions to end genocide and crimes against humanity and oversees rigorous field-based research and analysis in their reports and publications. Prior to joining the Enough Project, he was a senior advisor and director of the Program on Crisis, Conflict and Cooperation at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he also served at the United Nations for nearly 12 years, most recently as Chief of Staff of the UN Commission of Inquiry into the assassination of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan. Before joining the United Nations, Quarterman was a staff member of the Africa Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House, the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, just to touch on Benazir Bhutto and Pakistan, it sounds like in describing the north of Nigeria and the extent to which the British Empire ignored it because it was somewhat lawless, it reminds me of the Durand Line in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the territories that are essentially similar, right? They have self-rule, but they're kind of lawless.
It was interesting. That parallel struck me as I began to work on Pakistan after some years of working on and traveling back and forth to Nigeria. What's now Pakistan was basically run as not run by the same civilian colonial bureaucrats that the rest of India, that the rest, what was then the rest of India was run by, but rather by the British military. It was more a military-focused occupation than a civilian colonization. And that's carried over in Pakistan, with the military feeling that it has a special place in Pakistan's culture and history, that it considered itself to be the most modern and organized part of Pakistani culture, and led to a military that was about as coup happy, if not more so, as the military in Nigeria.
And if the military leadership generally came from the north, and the politicians from the south, then, of course, the resources, the oil, which is the main source of revenue for the country, which is in itself an extraordinary story because so much of it seems to disappear. What's the story then of how during the period of military rule, there was a kind of widespread looting of the economy? None of that got to the north as well, even though apparently the army was dominated by northern generals?
It did get to the north and caused enormous frustration, but it actually shows, paradoxically, that as many people have found, that natural resources can be as much a curse as a blessing. There was still more of an education base in the South. There was more support for entrepreneurialism, more business in the South. There really wasn't so much a Muslim, Christian, or animist divide there. It was really more, there was just more economic activity in the South. But the Northern rulers, under military governments and under civilian governments, made sure that a disproportionate amount of the revenues went north, probably most of that into the pockets of northern politicians and not so much into creating an infrastructure that was necessary for development. That infrastructure was already in the South, and even though it decayed over a number of years, it was possible, it's become possible to rebuild it. And the economic activity and entrepreneurialism that exists in the country, as I said, is largely in the South.
So, Mark Quarterman, back to the where we started talking about the attack on the convoy of the military commander by his own troops in the capital of the northern province, where Boko Haram is active. And apparently they're disgruntled about lack of pay and ineffective equipment to go after Boko Haram. And apparently, I would add to that the assumption that the fact that Western governments are trying to weigh in and help might be an insult to their morale. What's your sense then of why it is that they can't rein in and either, you know, capture or kill this group, since it's a pretty low-tech operation? Just AK-47s, you know,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of factors. One is this is really showing that the military is not the mighty force that Nigeria thought it was and maybe that it once was. I think secondly, as you've mentioned, Ian, there appear to be relationships between northern politicians and power brokers and Boko Haram, kind of the winking and nodding sometimes that above the table politicians have with below the table terrorist and Islamist groups in too many countries, which is another similarity with Pakistan. I think also it was a desire on the part of the government as a whole to sweep the problem under the rug in many ways. It's more difficult to deal with it. There were evidently warnings that the attack that led to the kidnapping of the girls might occur, and the government ignored them. There were also reports that President Jonathan initially turned down international support before the plight of the girls became an international issue. And that's not surprising. It was Boko Haram was an evil that the government was willing to have tolerated rather than taking the efforts needed to deal with them, because those efforts could have led to dissent, frustration, disagreement on the part of some northern politicians, and it was just too difficult to do anything about it.
So could it be this cynical, Mark Quarterman, that these northern politicians who have an under-the-table relationship with Boko Haram are destabilizing the country in order to get the South to cough up more revenues? I mean, in effect, reward them for for their collusion.
You know, that's one way to look at it, and that very much could be the case. Another way to look at it is Nigeria is an enormously difficult country to govern. It's massive, with a population edging up, I think, toward 200 million. It dwarfs its neighbors, you know, who at the top top population levels are maybe 20, 30 million, if that. It's a massive country physically. It's divided regionally. It's enormously corrupt, and civilian governments have not been able to root that out, and in some ways have taken part in the largesse. And so anything that makes the country easier to govern, including not governing parts of it, is probably what has been a strategy in Nigeria for many, many years. So even a non-cynical approach, or maybe a somewhat less cynical approach, would say, you know, why bother when we're not accountable to our citizens? We're enriching ourselves. We are, keeping a lid on things. It's bad, but not too bad. And it's more trouble to try to deal with this problem than to try to contain it.
So back then to the fate of these 200 to 300 schoolgirls that have now been captured for over a month. And apparently this is not heavy jungle canopy. This is fairly open country. It's pretty difficult to understand why, with all of our overhead assets, that we don't know where this camp is. So what is the continuing standoff about? Just the idea that you're dealing with a suicidal bunch, so the girls will end up as collateral damage?
I think that's one concern. Also, this raises an issue that we've been struggling with at the Enough Project and are beginning increasingly to center our work on, which is two things really: the transnational cross-border nature of conflicts. That many of the conflicts we look at are actually conflict systems. That Boko Haram has allies and friends in the region that it can work with, not just in Nigeria. You know, its reach doesn't end at Nigeria's border, even if that's its focus, and its support network doesn't necessarily end there. And so, for all we know, the girls are in Cameroon. They could be across the border in Niger as well. They could be in any number of places now, in Chad, and could be spread out too. So that video that we saw the other day of a number of girls in the camp, that could just be a portion of them, and they could be in a number of places and even in cities now in being held. Secondly, increasingly armed groups are paying for themselves and are gaining revenue by engaging in illicit trade, whether it's elephant poaching by the Janjaweed fighters from Sudan or trafficking in people. And so it could well be that these girls are now in a part of an international human trafficking network and so therefore can't be easily found too. It's not clear that they're just all together in a camp in the open, either in northern Nigeria or one of the other places that are largely savanna and open ground. They can be in any number of places. And that's a difficult aspect of it. Even though the U.S. now is beginning to provide satellite imagery to the Nigerians and is using aircraft that can take photographs of what's happening on the ground and pass that along as well, it's not entirely clear where the girls are. And because of the transnational nature and the illicit trade nature of armed groups, they could be anywhere.
Well, Mark Quarterman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Quarterman, who's Director of Research and Programs at Enough, where he formulates the Enough Project's policy prescriptions to end genocide and crimes against humanity and oversees rigorous field-based research and analysis in their reports and publications. Prior to joining the Enough Project, he was a senior advisor and director of the Program on Crisis, Conflict and Cooperation at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he also served at the United Nations for nearly 12 years, most recently as Chief of Staff of the UN Commission of Inquiry into the assassination of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan. Before joining the United Nations, Quarterman was a staff member of the Africa Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the European Courts of Justice decision against Google.